Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Voters in 2018, the midterms, sent a record number of women to Congress and to state legislatures nationwide. Of course, Iowa, for its part, elected its first two female members of the U.S. House of Representatives in a 172-year history, if my math is right, statehood of Iowa, way back in 1846. My guests this half hour are the authors of a new book that looks at the evolution of women's involvement in American politics from the colonial era all the way to the present. It's called Women in the American Political System, an encyclopedia of women as voters, candidates, and office holders. Joining us, the co-authors, Diane Bystrom, Director Emerita of the Carey Chapman Catt Center at Iowa State University. Hi, Diane.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now. Thanks.
Okay, good.
Thanks for joining us. Barbara Burrell, your co-author, joins us as well, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb. Barbara, we hope you're there.
I'm there.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we're hearing you. Thank you for joining us, Barbara. Diane, start us off. Tell us more about this book, this encyclopedia, and why the two of you wrote it, and why now?
Well, we got interested in doing this. We were contacted by a publisher who was interested in doing having this publication on an encyclopedia. And so an encyclopedia is a huge task, as you might imagine. And so we got interested in it. We were leading up to the 2016 election at the time. And so with Hillary Clinton already had announced her candidacy at the time we were contacted by the publisher, we thought, what a great time to do sort of this thorough update on women in the political system. And there hadn't been an encyclopedia published for several years, and so we thought it was very timely. As it turned out, not only timely, but certainly with the record number of women that ran and won in 2018, I think it's a really timely look, and as you said, a historical perspective of how women got involved in the political system up to the current time.
Mm-hmm. We hear so much in our news about current politics and women's role in politics and how that's changed in our record-setting 2018 election, but perhaps you can take us back. First of all, you've piqued my interest with the colonial era in women in politics. Give us a sense of the degree to which women were involved in politics back during the era of our founding fathers. Isn't it right to the right to vote only given not only to men, but also only to white landowners, right?
Yes, that's right. And that's another thing that I think makes this timely because, as we said in our preface to the book, it was being published at a time when organizations across the country, including in Iowa and also in Nebraska, where I am now, the League of Women Voters, getting ready to lead celebrations of the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment giving women the right to vote, which was ratified in 1920. And so there is certainly nationwide and in states already plans going for a big celebration of that. And, of course, Carey Chapman Catt, a graduate of Iowa State University, for whom the center I directed for 22 years is named, was certainly key in that. And so the thing I think is really great about this is it puts, like in our essays, it goes everywhere from the historical beginnings of women as political candidates, women as elected officials, women as appointed officials, women as voters, and women in the judiciary, and takes it all the way back from those first women that ran and won or got involved as appointed office and takes it through the current time. So there's not anything I know on the market that does that.
Mm-hmm. Barbara, talk a little bit about your role in this encyclopedic work of women in politics in the U.S.
Diane asked me to join partway through the project, and I've done a lot of research on women as political candidates and also looked historically at first ladies and back to the suffrage movement. So my research sort of paralleled Diane's in many ways, covering a long history of women in politics.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about candidates, Diane. Talk about the rise of women candidates. When do we see the first women candidates?
Well, going back, we saw women running for elected office way back until the 1800s, and certainly our chapter on that, you know, looks into that. So women were running for political office, and there's actually a great website that won a Cat Prize a couple years ago. It's called Her Hat Was in the Ring, and so that really documents women that really ran for office before the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, giving women the right to vote, was even ratified. So women were running for office in some states. A lot of states had limited suffrage, which would mean that a woman could run for example, school board. Some states had full suffrage, like some of the western states, and so women were running for political office back in the 1800s, and the chapter on women as political candidates documents that and as elected officials.
So just to break in there, Diane, so we had a time in our country's history when women could not vote, but they could run and did run for office?
That's exactly right. So there were some states that had, for example, limited suffrage. So that would mean, for example, the first woman mayor was Susanna Salter in Argonia, Kansas, elected in the 1800s, and so she ran for mayor in that. And so I think in that case, she had to be elected by men, but she could run. But there were some states that had limited suffrage where women could vote for very limited offices. They could vote, for example, for school board. That was fairly common in some of the Midwestern states. You know, I think the citizenry thought, oh, gee, women know about school boards. And so a lot of times, even before the 19th Amendment, some states had full suffrage before the 19th Amendment, and so women could vote in every race. And then some had limited suffrage where women could vote typically for school board, sometimes for mayor.
Mm-hmm. When women gained the right... Yeah, go ahead, Barbara.
I just wanted to jump in and say, and there are even cases where... feminist leaders, women's rights leaders like Susan B. Anthony actually challenged the right to vote by going out and actually voting and then being put on trial for that.
Being put on trial? Thrown in jail? Or fined?
She never was really thrown in jail, but then they fined her and she never paid the fine. But that was way back in, Diane, help me, 1872.
Well, 1870, yes, and that's one of the many court decisions that are in our book, the U.S. versus yes. Susan B. Anthony. So she never served a day in jail, and it's an interesting read in that entry. So that's all documented in our encyclopedia.
Mm-hmm. Diane Bystrom is with us, Barbara Burrell, they're authors of a new encyclopedia, Women in the American Political System, an encyclopedia of women as voters, candidates, and office holders. This is so interesting with the history going back as far as you do. We really get a sense of how, I guess you can take two steps forward, maybe a half a step back. Diane, is that the sense that you get when you look at this long arc?
I think so. You know, certainly when it comes to women in elected office, but again, it's really a rich history of how women did run for office before the 19th Amendment was passed. It's a rich history, I think, and again, I think the essays really bring that out. The entries do as well. You know, one thing that Barbara mentioned is that we do similar research. Barbara didn't say it, but she's actually a graduate. She got her master's degree from Iowa State University, and we've met each other a long time ago. She has her PhD from Michigan, and so we do similar research, but her degree is in political science and mine's in communication. So although we study the same things, we study it from a slightly different perspective, and I think that brings a lot of richness to the book.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about a landmark not mentioned yet that you point to in this book, in the encyclopedia, that we haven't touched on, that you see as significant in the history of women's political history.
Barbara, you want to take that?
Could you repeat the question?
Another landmark in women's political history in this country that you pointed out in your encyclopedia.
Well, let me also expand on it. We don't just cover women running for elective office in the encyclopedia.
Mm-hmm.
Politics is very broad there, including women to appointed office, women as judges, and women organizing to promote other women and women's candidacies. So the book is pretty broad. I guess one of the major things would be the 1972 passage of the Equal Rights Amendment in Congress, which, of course, never actually became part of the Constitution.
Right.
That was huge.
The ERA in the 1970s did not get enough states on board, if I'm remembering my history right. But that made an impact, Barbara?
Oh, absolutely. Women organizing and thinking about how women are discriminated against, and particularly in the homes as housewives, in the economic system. And we're now still trying to get the Equal Rights Amendment passed, which you might not know. and being here in North Carolina, and we could be the next state to gain at least the 3-4 states to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. It will then have a lot of court challenges, but it's still big.
Yeah, actually, as Barbara said, when we were writing this book, and there is an entry on the Equal Rights Amendment, actually 2 states ratified the Equal Rights Amendment in the 3 years that we were working on the book. And so states are still actually taking that up. But certainly that would be a landmark to achieve. Certainly another landmark that we did not achieve in 2016, but is still on the horizon, is electing the first woman president. So those are certainly landmarks that have not been achieved, but are still achievable.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about issues, what issues do women tend to support in the present and in the past? Are they consistent? Gender differences in policy priorities is an interesting topic you touch on as well.
I'll jump in here first, and then Barbara, please add on it. I mean, certainly there's a lot of research that, and it's covered in the book, on kind of the gender gap, not only in voting behavior, but in policy preferences. And so, you know, typically women have different points of view on from men on certain public policy issues. But a lot of times what we've found in the research is that they really identify with the same issues. The economy is typically a top issue in any campaign, but women and men might see it from a different perspective, with women having more of a perspective of earning, you know, 80 cents on the dollar now, or 78, whatever it is. And so they're sort of on the fringes of the economy sometimes, so they see the economy in a different way. And I guess kind of to summarize it sort of globally is that a lot of research finds that women are more supportive of the role in government in their life, government programs, things like that, when it comes to any issue, or men are not. Barbara, you want to add some more to that policy? Because I know you've done a lot of research in that area.
Right. Well, certainly on a lot of social issues like gun control and violence, women and much more in favor of gun control than men, and less willing to go to war and using military aggressively. That's been a second area in addition to the economy where there's been differences. Where there has not been a difference, interestingly, is on abortion rights. Men and women have been equally supportive and opposed to abortion rights.
So Roe v. Wade, going back to the early 1970s, is a landmark that you would mark here as well, Barbara.
Right, but it's a landmark that has less differences between men and women.
Hmm. Diane, jump in there.
Okay, same kind of thing, as I think, as Barbara pointed out, is that's one thing that you probably intuitively would think that there might be a big difference in public opinion on reproductive rights. And as Barbara said, there really isn't. Most polling shows that men and women are both equally, the same numbers are opposed to abortion rights as favor reproductive rights. And so that's something that I think surprises a lot of people, although I don't know why it would. You know, in some ways it's not really a gender issue, but I think intuitively sometimes people think that it might be. So there's really not a big difference between men and women when it comes to that issue, and that surprises people.
Female candidates in political history are given a lot of attention, but as you mentioned there, Barbara, the women appointed to office, or women in the judiciary, is also part of our politics. Did that pretty much mirror the way women progressed got more and more part of the elected scene when we're talking about appointed office, or how did that differ?
It's somewhat similar. It's been a long, a hard slog to equal men in terms of especially highly appointed offices. If you think about women in the states, governors appointing women, there's a substantial gender gap there. Substantial gender gap in terms of women being judges. You look at the Supreme Court, we have 3 women judges and 6 men. And each time a woman has gotten appointed, it's been a major, major issue politically. So there's progress, lots of progress, but there's still a big gender gap.
Voters in the 2018 midterms sent a record number of women to Congress, Barbara and Diane, as you're well aware. Also to state legislatures nationwide. Iowa elected its first 2 female members of the U.S. House of Representatives in Iowa's history, going back to 1846 and statehood. But let's talk a little bit about the political parties and their differences in electing women or having female candidates. A record 89 Democratic women were elected from the Democratic Party to the House in 2018. Republicans, according to what I've read, have never had more than 25 women, set a record in 2006. And now only 13 Republican women in the U.S. House after this election, the lowest number of Republican women in the House in a quarter century. Diane, explain the difference. Was there a divergent? Was there a certain point where the parties diverged here and had this this major gender gap develop?
I think so. And Barbara's actually studied political parties more than I do. So I will jump in and hope Barbara will finish up and probably to add a lot more than I have to say. I think that there was more equity back, I think, in the 70s and 80s between the political parties, and there's been a growing difference ever since, I'm going to say Reagan, and that may not be the wrong milestone, but when Reagan was elected president, there was more difference between Democrats electing women and Republicans. Part of the notion is that, you know, you have a primary stage in our election system, and in the primary stage, you tend to have more activist voters. And so as the Republican Party, after the election of Ronald Reagan, became more and more conservative, and Republican women were seen as more moderate, they had a tougher time winning at that primary stage, where their Democratic sisters did not, because they were seen as more moderate to liberal on the Democratic side, so they had more success at the primary level. And so what you see now, but I do think that, you know, you see the Republican Party after, you know, 2012 said we've got a women's problem and we're going to address it, but they really never did. And I like, you know, there's a story that just circulated earlier this week, and I think it was Elise Stefanik of New York who said, you know, I didn't ask for your permission. And so there's Republican women now getting pretty, I think, fed up with not having that same electoral success as Democrats. So, Barbara, again, you've studied political parties more than me, so what would you add?
Well, no, I totally agree with you. And if you look at the past 20 years or so, in 1992, the year of the woman was really more the year of the Democratic woman, and that's when things really started to diverge between the two parties. And the Democratic Party has set up organizations that have promoted women, and the women running tended to be more liberal, more professional than, say, the more conservative Republican women who were more in the home. So there is that big difference, and it's just amazing this year. It's a huge gap.
Yeah. So why, when we talk about more recent years, why haven't Republicans expanded their ranks of women the way the Democrats have really exploded here? Barbara.
Well, they've tried. They've set up a number of times different organizational attempts to promote women candidates, but it's just not part of the Republican Party sort of philosophy to deal with identity politics. So they, you know, they go for candidates as individuals rather than looking for specific candidates based on sex or some other kinds of characteristics, whereas the Democratic Party has been much more oriented towards expanding who gets elected to office. And the women have formed organizations within the Democratic Party that's much more sympathetic to those ideas.
Mm-hmm. This question to you, Diane, what is your sense of how the Me Too movement, just over a year old, I believe, has reshaped our political landscape, especially for women?
Well, I think it's really broadened. You know, I study more the communication aspects of campaigns, and one of the things that I saw anecdotally this year, and certainly will hope to study in a more quantitative research way, is how women characterize themselves in their political advertising and also in their social media. You had women this year talking about being sexually harassed or sexually discriminated about at work. And there was a study by the Barbara Lee Family Foundation that came out shortly before the 2018 election that showed that voters actually were more interested in sort of the story, you know, stories of women, both men and women voters were interested in women that were kind of attacking the issue of sexual harassment, sexual discrimination, not in a really personal way, but making it part of the campaign. And so it seems to be an issue that I think at least broadened the dialogue of the campaign, where you had women, again, talking about it. The other big thing that we saw this year is women using the fact that they were mothers as an attribute. And so there had been some inklings about that back toward to the 2014 election, but certainly it was very robust in 2018. I guess the other theme that we saw a lot was the number of veterans running, both male and female, in this last election cycle.
Right. And Barbara, what do you see as the lasting impact of the Me Too movement on women in politics?
Well, I think, as Diane said, it's the fact that women are now speaking up and challenging the traditional male dominance and pointing out the ways in which they've been battered and treated badly. And you see, you know, when hundreds of thousands of women go out and protest after the presidential election and then continue to speak out against it, then that's a real lasting impact.
Mm-hmm. When we look toward the future, how do we make sure the so-called Year of the Woman, I know 92 was also called Year of the Woman, as is 2018, how do we make sure it's not just that, just a year, but a mark that we can build on, Diane?
Well, I think, and I think Barbara will add to this because she studies women's organizations, but one thing that I saw, so of course, the Carrie Chapman Catt Center offers Ready to Run Iowa every other year, and they'll be offering it in 2019. And so I think one of the things I've seen with these other organizations and then documented in the encyclopedia is how a number of organizations built off the 2016 election, built off the marches that are taking place, built off the Me Too movement. And so campaign training schools for women just burst in the number of women. We had 172 at Ready to Run Iowa in 2017. The previous record before that was 71. And so you have all these women now wanting to run for office. And so I think organizations like the Catt Center, like others across the country, She Should Run, there's some others. Emily's List has some training. But there's a lot of training programs across the country. Emerge Iowa is a new one in the state of Iowa. It's a national organization as well. For Democratic candidates, Ready to Run Iowa is nonpartisan, so it's for Democrat and Republican candidates. One of the things that I have a meeting on next week is trying to start a campaign school in Nebraska because we have a lot of work to do here. And so, but, you know, just really pleased. I mean, Iowa, as you know, will either have a record number of 45 or 46, whatever is happening in House District 55, which I tried to look it up this morning. I'm not sure what's going on there. But we'll at least have 45 women, up from 35. So our percentage of women in the Iowa legislature will go from 23.3% to 30%, which is a huge increase, and I think really can, you know, make an impact. Barbara, I want to add to
okay,
that,
okay,
please.
Okay, we've run out of time. Diane Bystrom, okay. Thank you very much. Retired director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center at ISU, Barbara Burrell, of the professor emeritus of political science at Northern Illinois University in DeKalb. Thank you both for joining us, co-authors of Women in the American Political System, an encyclopedia of women as voters and candidates and office holders. Diane and Barbara, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us, Ben.